Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, and welcome to the Progressive Britain podcast. I'm your host, Joe Holland. In this episode, as part of the Progress History Project, I speak to Chris Clarke, author of The Dark Knight and The Puppet Master. It's a book centred on three myths that occupy the populist left: The Dark Knight, The Puppet Master, and The Golden Age. Chris and I talk about the myths, look at the evidence behind them, and discuss their consequences. His book really is an eye-opener, even for someone who already sees themselves as a pluralist, a word that Chris focuses on throughout, and his argument and evidence are watertight and convincing. I'd recommend his book to anyone interested in politics, particularly Labour politics, but also anyone who wants to understand society better. Here's my discussion with Chris on his book, The Dark Knight and The Puppet Master. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for coming on the Progressive Britain podcast.
Cool. Thanks very much for having me.
So I want to get straight down to it. Could you, for our listeners, briefly break down these three myths that you explain in your book?
Yeah, the book focuses on three narratives, which, in my view, really get in the way of progressive politics and progressive goals. They stop us from achieving what we want to achieve. So they're very counterproductive narratives, and they're also narratives which take us into quite dangerous and sometimes not, you know, unethical territory, if you like. So the three myths are, I call them the Dark Knight. That's knight with a K, so it's the kind of idea of a dark knight against the white knight struggle, that politics is always a struggle between good and evil. The puppet master, which is the idea that all of society's problems are essentially authored or come with the blessing of the powerful, and the golden era, which is a sort of cherry picked version of the past, which imagines the past as a kind of socialist Arcadia, a moment of original socialism from which we've steadily deteriorated into a bleak neoliberal future. And my view is that these three narratives are fundamentally barriers to actually doing progressive things and achieving left-wing goals.
And you set out the myths very convincingly in the book, and you, for anyone who hasn't read the book, you dedicate effectively, I'd say, almost a third to each myth, with slightly more to the golden era towards the end of the book. But each one of them you outline and you go into detail using a lot of data and evidence to prove why the myths exist, empirics that support the foundation of your argument. And I want to delve into that. So could we first go to the Dark Knight myth, the first myth that you present, this perpetual struggle between good and evil? In chapter 6, you talk about these human complexities that can and should preempt Dark Knight thinking. And then in chapter 18, you go on to say that the Dark Knight myth is the myth with the least truth to it of the three. So I want to ask you if you think, even though there is so little truth in the Dark Knight myth, if reliance on the kind of human complexities that would preempt the myth, if building our politics around these complexities could be unhelpful to left-wing movements attempting to garner broad support, especially in the face of right-wing populist movements and parties that offer such clear, simple, dark night narratives to voters? Is the best way to counter right-wing populism a recognition of the human complexity and the destruction of the dark night thinking? Or what would you say to the argument that the best way to counter right-wing populism is a clear left-wing dark night counter narrative that is simple for voters to understand and take on?
Yeah, my argument in the book that I am making is that overall is that left-wing populism is not the best way of taking on right-wing populism. And in fact, is also not the is not a kind of ethical or correct way to take on right-wing populism. And my argument is that we should avoid ways of thinking which say the political spectrum is a moral spectrum. Things that people that are right-wing or people that hold right-wing views are bad people or are driven by spite or self-interest or callousness of some kind. And reject those sort of us and them narratives, which I think underpin elements of the left and certainly elements of left-wing populism. My issue, and when I talk about human complexity in the book, what I'm aiming to talk about is the fact that any individual has a whole set of things that are aspects of their identity. So they could be a Tory voter who also relies on welfare, who reads The Guardian, who works in the public sector, who's from a working class background, or whatever it may be. People are complex, and if you start to say somebody that votes Conservative is a bad person, full stop, or somebody that works in the private sector is a bad person, full stop, you immediately remove that complexity and you essentially outgroup whole swathes of society, if you like. So you outgroup the Daily Mail reader who votes Labour, and there are actually a sizable group of those people. You outgroup the person who works in the private sector who's actually sort of quite supportive of redistributive taxation, whatever it may be. The idea that politics is a struggle of good against evil immediately judges people who do not agree with you on every single point as being bad people and essentially outgroups them. And so I think it's quite a kind of unethical and unhelpful and divisive way to behave, to go into this what I call white knight, dark knight, us and them, good and evil way of viewing politics. But I also think it's electorally counterproductive, because if you're interested in a sort of broad coalition, the dark knight way of thinking is exactly the wrong way to go about it. It narrows the church, it shrinks the tent, and ultimately it means that only a very small group who are kind of left-wing, quotes unquotes, on every single point remain the good guys, as it were.
And I don't think you actually explicitly said the word pluralist there, but that is a word that obviously I've taken, it's a word I've essentially taken from the book. I didn't really, I think, kind of categorically think of myself as a pluralist before reading this book. I guess if I was questioned, I would have said yes, but now I certainly identify much more clearly to myself as a pluralist after reading your book. It felt like my thoughts and opinions were kind of laid out on the page. My politics were kind of articulated for me in that first chapter when I read the book. And I know that Peter Kyle said something very similar at the launch of your book with Progress and Policy Network a couple of weeks ago, that he felt his politics was kind of laid out on the page. So effectively what you're saying is that this pluralism that you're advocating, I guess necessarily, in creating a Dark Knight myth, you're ignoring a lot of the views of a lot of other people on the political spectrum. So effectively, if you want to be a pluralist, I guess it's kind of logically necessary that you cannot engage in Dark Knight myths and can't therefore ignore any part of the electorate simply because they don't engage with the same ideas that you do on that level.
Yeah, absolutely. You've really got to the nub of it there, Joe. I think I set out in the book that the alternative to populism is not sort of centrism or neoliberalism or whatever people like to think it is. The alternative to populism is pluralism, which is this idea that essentially society has a diversity of opinion within it. And that is not necessarily a bad thing. And that if you assume that people who are on the other end of that spectrum of opinion are bad people, then you automatically assume that people who are a bit closer to them or a bit more in the middle are slightly worse people than you. And you quite quickly get to a point where you've got a very, very small kind of ragtag group of people who are kind of the good guys in your book. So to operate in a democracy, you need to accept that there's a diversity of opinion and that there will be people who are to the right of you, people who disagree with you on certain points, people who, even if on 90% of the issues are a kind of a card-carrying socialist, might have an area where you're not at all comfortable with what they think. And all of those things are really essential to functioning in a democracy. So in a certain respect, I think the Dark Knight myth, the idea that the other side are enemies, are scum, are vermin, to use the more extreme examples that you sometimes get on social media, is kind of runs counter to democracy, really, and to the idea that there has to be necessarily a mixture of opinions in any society.
No, definitely. And I think the evidence that you use throughout the book, also in the other parts of the book, in the Puppet Master and Golden Era sections, but the evidence you use to show that the clear moral and policy differences and complexity that exists across electorates in the UK and elsewhere, I think is really clear that being a pluralist is, if you're going to build an electoral coalition, the way forward. And I really want to get on to some of that later. But first, if we could just stay with the Dark Knight. In chapter 7, I think, where you talk about the case against the Dark Knight from a perspective of policy, you differentiate between the two-tier model, the populist model, and the four-tier model, the pluralist model. The two-tier model being that people have an image, and then they have their principles behind that image. And the image can be political. It's the image you present publicly. And then the principles underlying that are who you really are. And that is, you're explaining in the book, that's a simplified way of seeing it. The more true way to see it is that we have an image which we present. And then below that, we have policy and strategy that informs that image. And then we have political values that inform that policy and strategy. And then below those values, we have personal morals, which inform those political values, in turn inform the policy and strategy, and then the image. And my question to that is that, would you say that existing in that way runs slightly counter to the way that humans work? Because it's a lot easier in any situation to pick a side, to say that side's true to who I am, like you say, to be with the in-group at that moment. So the four-tier model seems like, for a rational person, for a rational political thinking person, it's definitely the right way to proceed. But does it overcomplicate and therefore stand in opposition to the way that we tell stories about ourselves and others?
I guess it does in a way. But these two models that I talk about, just to explain them briefly, I've tried to break apart a person's, what I call their personal morals from their political values to begin with. So I've tried to say that someone can be a decent person who would pass basic moral tests, be it, you know, helping a single mum carry a pram up a flight of stairs or whatever it might be, whilst also having political values which we would fundamentally disagree with. And then I've tried to say, even within people whose political values we share, people might have different ideas about doing things. So classically within Labour, there might be people who share political values but think that, you know, a greater level of private sector involvement is necessary to achieve those values, or whatever it might be. So it's trying to break apart the layers, rather than, so that you avoid the point where you start to say, okay, this person supports this policy that I disagree with, therefore they don't share my political values, therefore they're a bad person. That's what I'm trying to argue against. But I completely agree with you that in a certain respect, this, what I'm arguing, runs counter to human nature in a way, runs counter to human nature to say people are to think, okay, that person supports that policy, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they that they are supporting that policy because they are a bad person who wants people in poverty to suffer or whatever it might be. So I do agree with you with that to a point. And I think one of the things I tried to sort of accommodate within the book is an acceptance that these three myths I talk about, particularly the Dark Knight myth, also during the Golden Era, are quite attractive and seductive as ways of story, as modes of storytelling. To a certain extent, we need to examine them to avoid being seduced sometimes, I think. But I think it goes, the Dark Knight myth, in a way, it's quite helpful for people who are activists, because it really galvanizes you against the other side and allows you to go, they're the bad people, they support this policy, which means they support these values, which means they're fundamentally corrupt or venal or immoral individuals, and that makes you that enthusiastic and passionate about the side that you're advocating. But I also think that that can be quite destructive and can prevent a dialogue of any kind if you start from the position that because someone who has a slightly different view of you to you on a kind of narrow point about housing policy or geopolitics is coming from a position of avarice or spite, then that causes the political dialogue to completely break down. So I think it is seductive, the Dark Knight myth, the us and them myth, but we need to fight against that.
And you mention in one of the latter chapters that there is something inherently difficult in trying to get someone to change the fundamentals of their view. So I certainly, I see the difficulty, but I certainly think that you're right in examining them. I mean, there's no way you can read your entire book and still believe these myths, because once you read it, I feel like the readers examine these myths to an extent that they can't any longer indulge in them. I want to turn to the Puppet Master. I loved the bit in the book where you talked about William Paley. And for anyone who's not familiar, William Paley was, I think it was initially a religious argument that he put forward, I think, about the idea of a watchmaker, i.e. God, necessarily existing because the world is too complex, just like a watch is too complex to have come into existence by chance or randomly. So just as a watch must have a watchmaker, there also must be a God. And then you also, in the same chapter, use the metaphor of Occam's razor, the idea that the simplest argument is usually the one that is correct. And these two metaphors that you use, you use them to talk to kind of, I feel like, lend to a chaos-based explanation of the world, which, of course, is directly contradictory to the idea of a puppet master controlling it. So I really want to... If you could talk to us a bit about the way you see the world from the perspective of it being predominantly based in chaos rather than, like you say, authored by a puppet master.
Yeah, absolutely. This is this was the second myth. It's, as you say, it's the puppet master, and I use the William Paley example because it was a metaphor that was used within philosophy. To defend the design argument, to defend to sort of lend credibility to the idea that there was a God, there was a grand creator, the world was too perfect, too meticulous and perfectly formed to have just been created out of nothing, or to have been created organically or naturally. So William Paley was a philosopher who was arguing in favour of the existence of God on that basis. And I compare that to the puppet master because I say that people on the left look at the inequalities in the world, the 1% owning this enormous amounts of wealth or at things which fly in, things like climate change, which seem like they should be so easy to solve and yet go unsolved. And they assume that there must be some kind of almost a godlike figure, some kind of small, clever group pulling the strings or working together to make society this unfair and unequal, as unfair and unequal as as people in the populist left see it. So I think that I use that metaphor as an example because I think it's really important to challenge it and to say, actually, the world's problems do not come in every instant because there is a powerful elite crushing the will of the people. I mean, they might come for that reason in periods of totalitarian government or in a kind of feudal society, historic feudal society. But in the modern day, I think less and less do they come through those reasons. And more, the problems of the world come through a kind of chaotic, anarchic, organic system, if you like, be it globalization, which means that governments have less and less power over their over where businesses choose to settle or how businesses, how fluid capital is, or be it a kind of a 24-hour news media, which scrutinizes and creates these very short-term incentives for politicians and for people in the public eye. I think that fundamentally we live in a chaotic world, not a conspiracy, and that the problems that the left seeks to address come through chaos, not conspiracy. To give one obvious example, the rise of inequality in the past 40 years or so has come in a period. My explanation of that would be that it's come as a result of it being easier and easier for businesses to settle abroad, easier and easier for businesses to relocate their sort of tax bases to other countries to circumnavigate certain regulations. It's become easier and easier for an industry to relocate to a place where labour is cheaper or land is cheaper. And on top of that, you've got changes in the values of the society, quite organic changes in the values of the society as people have become better off, more of an emphasis on property ownership, for example. I think these things, all of them in their individual ways, explain the rise of inequality far better than the idea that a kind of small neoliberal elite put their heads together during the 1970s and 80s and worked out a way of kind of subjecting the rest of us to a system that benefited only them. So that's the kind of argument I'm trying to make. And I think it's essential that the Labour Party and the left in general really engages this with these problems, because one of the big problems with the puppet master narrative, quite apart from everything else, is that it means you're incapable of really understanding where problem societies are and incapable of engaging with the limitations of power. So what you end up with is a kind of really simplistic view of politics that all we need to do is sort of get into the cockpit, as it were, and put the brake on and turn the poverty dial down to zero and turn the inequality dial off and whatever it might be. So I think it's really important that the left actually engages with a society which is chaotic and anarchic and organic, rather than imagining that there's this grand creator somewhere.
And in directly, as it relates to the mainstream media, you talk a lot about the feedback loop between media and readership or viewers or listeners, and how newspapers or media sources are reactive to the views of their voters, of their readers, sorry, and they know what their readers want to hear, and they know what is going to sell them newspapers or what is going to get them views. How did you come to this understanding of the way the media works and this feedback loop? Did you go into that with the idea fully formed, or was it looking at the evidence and the research that you present that brought you to that position? Because I do think the research you present is clear, and it does show a feedback loop. It shows that it's not the media manipulating the public on every issue, like people who believe in the puppet master tend to think. So I'm interested to know how you came to that understanding about the feedback loop between the media and between readers and viewers, and why you think it's so easy for populists to give so much weight to the media in their puppet master theories.
Yeah, well, I noticed, and I was very frustrated with Corbyn's leadership really from day one. But one of the first things that emerged was this absolutely this whole narrative around the mainstream media, quotes the MSM, a whole set of things about we are his media, which was a kind of hashtag that did the rounds in about, I think about 2016, a whole way of seeing and understanding the media, which was based on the media in Britain being not just biased towards the right, which I think they are narrowly biased towards the right, but yes, biased towards the right, but actually being you know, seeking to control society, seeking to act as a propaganda machine for the Conservatives in order to keep Labour out of government because they were frightened of what Labour might do in power. Now, I simply just did not believe that way of seeing the world. It didn't chime with my experiences of reading the newspapers. It didn't chime with anything that I was seeing. Moreover, I'd been a press officer at various points in my life. I'd been a press officer for various Labour candidates and worked with the media in that capacity in as a kind of fairly low-level press officer doing the rounds. And my sense was constantly that you weren't engaging with this great MSM machine that sought to silence people. You're engaging with a really anarchic, responsive entity that was constantly dropping people to get other people on the programmes, or was constantly looking for the most sensationalist or kind of simplistic soap opera form of argument. So I'm not supportive of the media within the book necessarily, and with the role that the media plays in politics. But what I argue is that its problems come from being short-termist, quick to looking for simple solutions and simple explanations, not through it being a kind of propaganda arm of the powerful. And to look at that, and I think there's lots and lots of examples that sort of demonstrate that. Even if you look at the coverage of the 2008 banking crisis, for example, you find papers like the Daily Mail and the Sun doing huge exposés of bankers who'd broken the rules during the crisis, quite rightly in many cases. But even stuff like that completely undermines the idea, which a lot of left populists like to buy into, that the papers seek to focus on immigrants or on welfare claimants because they're seeking to protect their friends in high places. It came from a combination of my own experience as a reader, but also my experience engaging with the media and trying to get place stories in the media or respond to stories from the media, which none of these things pointed towards a carefully calculated system looking to quote, manufacture consent, to use the Noam Chomsky phrase. Rather, it pointed to a real kind of law of the jungle type thing. So what I do in the book is I talk about the idea of the MSM, and the counterpoint I use is Tony Blair's description of the media from when he left office, which was the feral beasts analysis. He had very little time for the media and their role in politics, but he talked about feral beasts tearing up reputations, kind of grabbing hold of anything that was of interest, and a real kind of free for all law of the jungle. And I thought that was a much better analysis of where the media goes wrong when it's at its worst than the kind of idea that Jeremy Corbyn consistently put forward of a system rigged by billionaires, as he's been in the past.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Turning to another specific example of the Puppet Master myth, something which obviously has been in the news a lot recently, which is anti-Semitism. And I think anti-Semitism is, you know, after I knew before reading the book, but after reading the book, it's even more clear. Anti-Semitism is such a perfect example of the Puppet Master myth. And I think you say towards the end of the book that it's like the Puppet Master myth with Dark Knight ideas about the Middle East added in. So I want to get your views on how you see anti-Semitism as relates to the Puppet Master myth, and why the Puppet Master myth means that so many on the populist left and the right as well, but are unable to renege on their anti-Semitism, to apologize, to understand the ill of their ways, and how that relates to the fact that they simply can't take themselves away from their Puppet Master worldview.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the anti-Semitism stems within the left from the fact that or in a large part it stems from conspiracy theories, but from ways of thinking which are, I suppose, the thinner end of the conspiracy theory wedge as well. The idea that there's a small group who control things kind of feeds into and bleeds into ways of thinking on the populist left at almost every level. To give an example, there's a quote I think I used in the presentation from Owen Jones, who he says, "Today's establishment is made up of powerful groups that need to protect their position in a democracy in which almost the entire adult population has the right to vote. This establishment represents an attempt on behalf of these groups to manage democracy to make sure it doesn't threaten their own interests." So I'm not accusing Owen Jones of being on the kind of full crank left, but that's the kind of way of thinking which I think infects large parts of the Corbyn project, because it imagines this relatively small group managing democracy and suppressing the popular will. And once you start to think about who this group are, this 1% managing the popular will, you start to say, well, who could they be? Because no one that I know in my personal life is sort of superhuman enough to micromanage events so that they pan out exactly as they'd hoped. Nor are many of the people I know in my life inhuman enough that they do that and keep the rest of us poor and everything else for an extra zero on their bank balance. So once you've decided that society has got this kind of 1% who are fundamentally kind of both in superhumanly competent and inhumanly callous, so whether you, if you think that to a greater or lesser degree, you start to think, who is that group? Where does that group exist? Where do they come from? How do they get to be in these positions of power? And I think for some people on the left, on the populist left, that leads into anti-Semitism, because you've got this ethnic group kind of hiding in plain sight as they see it, you know, controlling things or planning out secret agendas, kind of Zionist agendas or whatever it may be. At the more extreme end, you get the idea that even something like the 9/11 was planned by that group or whatever it might be. But the in my view, the puppet master way of seeing society, the way of seeing society based on an all-powerful 1% or a very powerful 1% who keep the rest of us down, is fundamentally almost, if you like, a gateway drug to anti-Semitism, because you cannot help but begin to wonder, who are these people? How did they get there? And for a small number of people on the far left, I think that crosses the tracks into overt racism.
It's incredibly interesting. I found it so so convincing, so clear, the idea that puppet master theory contributes to anti-Semitism and explains it to a large extent. I want to turn to the golden era myth. I think this is probably for me the most interesting of the myths. I think you do spend the most time on it in the book. And what you do is you lay out the golden era myth, and then you lay out, I think, 8 different potential narratives that we could view as core or central since World War II. And maybe you lay out these 8 narratives as different ways of viewing the world, as opposed to the golden era theory that we need to go back to this perfect time that existed previously in history. And I want to ask you, of those 8 narratives that you present, what do you think is the most convincing of those? Which of those do you think has the best potential to, in the public perception, the mainstream, to usurp the golden era narrative? And why that narrative? Why do you think that one that you're going to choose is the most effective? It is the most convincing?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really interesting question. And just to explain where those, I think it was actually 7 alternate narratives come from. But where they come from is that this golden era idea is, I think, a really integral part of left-wing thinking, or left populist thinking, as I put it. It's this idea of that there was a sort of an original socialism that Labour was fighting for, and that Labour achieved or embodied in some sense, and that original socialism has been sort of whittled away gradually by, usually by neoliberalism, is the word that tends to be used here. Neoliberalism is the kind of coronary artery, if you like, of the golden era myth. And what this myth says is that we lived in a progressive left-wing world based on community, collectivism, people looking out for each other, etc. And that from certainly from 1979 onwards, that world departed, and that in a certain respect we need to return to that world, and that we can return to that world. And I think a good example of the myth is, for example, the film Spirit of 45 by Ken Loach, which paints this kind of glorious past and then the decline into the present. So I looked at these 7 myths because I wanted to look at, well, if this idea isn't true, if it's not true that there was this glorious golden age of socialism at some point in the past, either in the post-war years or even before that, which descended into the modern world, then what is the story of the past 7 or so decades of British history? What is the story of the successes and failures of the left, which is more convincing, if you like? There's a number of things I look at within it, and I suppose it's quite hard to pick out a single one, but the one that particularly, I suppose, is, I think, really important for people on the left to sort of think about is I call it the shift from groupish values to individualist values, to post-materialist values. I think these are 3 sort of different value sets, if you like. Groupish values are based on society, is based on kind of tribalism, looking after your group, looking after your community, but also very socially conservative, protecting, scanning the horizon for threats, so, not wanting to protect your community and your own, but not wanting to kind of seeing everything in terms of resources and threats. The second values group is individualism, which is, as it sounds, I suppose, more the move towards seeing yourself as an individual, striving to do well for yourself as an individual or for your family as an individual family, based on kind of aspiration and ambition and achievement. And then the third sort of values group is post-materialist values, which are based on a sort of wider global consciousness, a self-fulfillment, a kind of concern about ethics and society in a wider, more sort of philosophical sense, if you like. And these three value sets have, I think, existed in society throughout history, but historically, the first one I mentioned, the groupish values were much, much more common within society, I think, and there's quite a lot of evidence to back this up. You know, for example, the number of people supporting post-materialist statements like "I want to live in a society where ideas are worth more than money" has steadily increased. I think, in fact, doubled in the last 20 or 30 years or something like that. So the society was historically very much founded, I think, on groupish values of people, tight-knit communities, looking after their own, and a kind of tribalist, traditionalist way of viewing things, which was both had progressive elements in that people, you know, would join, you know, trade unions and there would be more of a sense of collectivism, but also non-progressive elements, you know, when it came to LGBT rights or the family as an institution being extremely important, the traditional family being very important. So I think our values have changed as a society, partly as a result of society becoming more affluent. I think you've got many more people with individualist values, which kind of Margaret Thatcher, for example, very much tapped into. I think that the tipping point where individualist values became more and more common in society was the thing that Margaret Thatcher understood and formed a political base around, and was able to tap into kind of aspirational working class voters and things like that. And later, Tony Blair kind of sought to understand that individualism and aspiration. And then more recently, we've got the rise of really post-materialist values being much more dominant in society, so that you've got, even things like the rise of veganism as a kind of common concern across society as something that is much more common. So I think there's been a much more, there's quite a curious development in society as values have become more mixed. And society hasn't been comprised of the kind of security-driven groupish values to the same extent to which it was during the 50s and 60s and 70s. If you remember, the 1945 to 1951 Labour governments were concerned with social security in terms of housing and the NHS, but also with national security in terms of NATO, for example. So that there was this very security-driven consensus that Labour was able to tap into, and that's gradually changed. So I think really trying to understand those values in society and how they've changed is really important for the left, rather than going back to this quite simplistic, quite misty-eyed idea that there was, there was an era of kind of fellow feeling and sort of perfect communities that looked after each other and looked and were kind of progressive in every sense, and that they've slowly been replaced by rampant consumerism and whatever else. I think it's important for us to not buy into that and to instead think about how values within society have really changed.
And I think that that's such an interesting point, such an interesting part of the book for me. I think it's probably the most consequential going forward. Obviously, it's not an election for 4 years, but looking to Labour's next next manifesto, looking to the next election and the promises they're going to make to the public and the platform on which they're going to try and win. Do you think that there needs to be far more emphasis on aspiration, a word you mentioned there? Because like you say, there was a rise in individualist thinking on the level of values towards the end of the middle to the end of the 20th century. And then post-materialism has to some extent taken over in the 21st. But I also feel that I agree, and looking at the evidence that you mentioned in the book, I think that there is a real mix of individualism and post-materialism in the current political climate. So what do you think that means for Labour's electoral strategy in 4 years? Do we need an emphasis on aspiration more? And how can we merge the individualist and post-materialist values to engage that coalition of voters?
Yeah, that's that's the sort of million dollar question, and I don't profess to know the answer in full to that. But and I think one thing I would say is it's much harder if you've got a really mixed society in terms of values. If you've got kind of post-materialist Guardian readers who are really very, very internationalist in their outlook, and you're trying to keep them in the camp at the same time as quite socially conservative voters that are put more from Labour's heartlands, I think that's a much harder ask than maybe a few decades ago when there wasn't quite such a diversity of values. And like I said, I don't profess to know the answer, but I mean, to look at one example, the seat of Putney was, I remember on dimly, I remember on election night in 1997, that being one of the, after the Michael Portillo moment, one of the biggest victories for Labour was winning that seat, I think really by the skin of their teeth, a solid Tory affluent seat in central London. And one of the things I was struck by on election night in 2019, in a much, much, much worse election for Labour across the country, was that they held on to Putney. And I think I'm right in saying that Labour's vote has actually increased in Putney over the subsequent years. So I'm just using Putney as an example of somewhere where I think increasingly kind of post-materialists, cosmopolitan values probably replaced individualist ones, and Labour's vote has probably become stronger. On the question of how you hold that together and how you win back both the red wall seats whilst keeping hold of the Putneys of this world, but also of the university seats where Labour has done so well, I think, like I said, I profess to have the answer, but I think that the key thing is that engaging in anything culture wars related is an absolute fool's errand. Getting into debates about whether Winston Churchill was a racist or not, and kind of, or whatever it might be, and you know, looking at Winston Churchill's kind of very mixed history, and seeking to present him as a hero or a villain, a white knight or a dark knight, for example, is something which can only alienate the post-materialist core that have increasingly voted Labour, or alienate the post-materialist, or the groupish kind of traditionalist voters that were the former Labour Party base. So yeah, that would be, and that's something I think Keir Starmer's done a very good job of, is avoiding wading into these issues about essentially quite small symbolic things, because I think they're the things, more than anything, more than actual policies, which create divides between the values group and make it very hard for Labour to cling on to both the kind of groupish value sets and the post-materialist value sets. So that would be my take on it, really. And I think obviously as part of that, you have to actually get the policies right so that we're able to address regional inequality, we're able to have substantive things to say on, you know, investing in town communities, addressing the regional inequality in many coastal towns or post-industrial towns, for example. But I also think focusing on that substance has to be the focus rather than getting involved in trivial debates or getting involved in trivial gestures like refusing to bow to the Queen or whatever else Jeremy Corbyn was getting up to.
And I think it sounds like you're saying if we understand the movement of these values across time since the Second World War, we'll understand what key cultural arguments or value-based arguments just do not make sense to get into and which of those will really surely turn voters away. And I think I have a much firmer grasp of that after reading your book. So I'd recommend anyone who's involved with determining Labour's next electoral strategy to give your book a read before they do so. One of the last arguments you make in the book is about the innocence to awareness shift. Another one of the narratives you described that the way we could look at the world since World War II. And I think it is a consequential and meaningful narrative for the future because the information epoch, which we find ourselves in, is a very novel one. I mean, with social media and 24-hour media, it's all come to fruition really over the course of my lifetime since the mid-90s. And I'm interested to know what you think about how this will affect these myths in the future. Do you see 24-hour news media, social media, this perpetual virtual town square as providing a base on which these myths will thrive? Or do you think that access to information will eventually lead us further towards the truth and away from these myths?
I think access to information has to ultimately be a good thing and lead us towards the truth. To kind of explain that myth, for those who haven't read the book, I talk about one of the final change that we've seen since the post-war years being the move from innocence to awareness and the move from, I suppose, a more deferential society to a more questioning and clued up society on many questions. But what I point out is that this move from innocence to awareness means that there is much more of a heightened anger about problems not being solved, much more of a, in a way, often a cynicism about things, which makes it a quite hard political environment to operate on when politicians have much higher levels of scrutiny, much higher levels of much lower levels of deference. To be absolutely clear, I'm not saying that's a bad thing that development has happened, but I think it's important that we think about that we are able to rationally analyse things. So one of the consequences I talk about in the book is that from innocence to awareness means that crime is much more reported, and there's a kind of phenomenon of everyone thinks that crime is going up because they thinks it's been going up for decades because they read about it in the newspapers, they hear about the worst examples of it, they see it on social media. They're much more aware of the crimes that do happen, but actually crime has, in a general sense, been falling quite steadily, certainly it was fallen steadily since, let's say, the 1980s. So how do you govern in an era where people are more exercised about crime, but there's less of it? I don't know the answer to that, but I think forms of public engagement are going to be increasingly important to this, and forms of really some of the sort of fact-checking elements as well. I'm not saying that myth-busting is the answer to this necessarily, but I think having rebuilding trust in certain sources so that you don't have the kind of social media stuff going on is quite an important element as well.
And turning to our in-group, if you like, the Labour Party, the left of politics here in Britain, and in America and across the world as well. You talk to the end of the book about the word moderate and centrist, and you refer to them kind of as if they're epithets. And I'm wondering where you land on that, whether you think that we should, as quote-unquote moderates, we should actually reject those terms. We should say, no, we are the true left-wingers. We are the left-wingers who truly want to see left-wing parties in power. And we reject any thinking or propositions from the hard left that they are the true left wingers and that we are centrists and moderates, and that actually what we should be what we should be putting forward is the idea that we are pluralists, and that has nothing to do with how far left wing we are in our views.
That would absolutely be my view. I think we on the quotes centre left have been much too willing to accept the argument that we're centrists, that we're kind of halfway between the two, that we're sort of splitters of the difference between left and right, and to suggest that our real issue with Corbynism is with and with what's happened in the last 5 years is with it being too left-wing, too redistributive, or too progressive in some sense. Certainly for me, that was never my issue with Jeremy Corbyn, and it was never my issue with that side of the Labour Party. My frustration was with these three myths, as I came to call them, and these ways of thinking about society, which I thought just didn't correspond with the society that I saw in front of me. And I think that if you believe in the Dark Knight myth, each of the myths makes it really hard for you to actually be effective in a political climate. If you believe in the Dark Knight myth, you're essentially unable to understand your opponents. If you believe in the puppet master myth, you're unable to understand power and how it operates. And if you believe in a golden era myth, you're unable to look at change and actually understand change and what's changing in society. So I would argue that the real difference between the two wings of Labour, which have been, you know, fighting on and off for the past 5 years, and in a certain sense on and off for since the party was founded, is between the kind of pluralist view of the world that you engage with society as it is, and you engage with power as it is, and you understand and adapt to change, and the, as I see it, the populist view of the world, that you contest the enemy, that you sort of present easy answers, that you claim that politics is easy, and that whenever anyone asks you about it, you hark back to this moment of original socialism that was what we should go back to. I think we should reject terms like centrist and moderate, certainly within some of the more than we have done within the internal debates that have been going on within the party, and say, look, we're people who are progressive, we're people who are radical, who are left wing in many cases, but who just don't see the world in the same way and don't believe in these bogey monsters and kind of monsters under the bed sort of a thing. I think that's where our wing of the party needs to make our argument is that we're pluralists, we're not centrists. Certainly for me, and I think we've got some quite strong arguments that we could make there. I mean, if you look at, let's say, the period between 97 and 2010, and then you look at during which the centrists, quote unquote, the moderates, the quote right of the party were in power. And then if you look at the period between 2010 and 2020, during which the soft left and then the far left are in power within the party, the UK as a whole, I would argue, moved in a much more progressive direction between 97 and 2010 than in the subsequent decade. And that might sound like a kind of a trite or provocative argument, but I genuinely, I'm on the side of the Labour Party that I am, because I believe it's more efficient at delivering progressive and left-wing goals, because it sees things more clearly. And I think we should be making that argument much more forcefully, really, certainly if there's if we arrive in a situation like we did in 2015.
I think something you're referring to there, and we didn't really have time to talk about it, but it's the Overton window, which you mentioned in the book. And I thought it was really convincing the way you laid out in clearly in the diagrams, the kind of physical movement of a window in the diagrams and explained throughout the different periods in the 20th century and then into the early 21st century, how the Overton window moved and how it moved in a way that we maybe didn't even realize, and that it was affecting our values, and it was affecting our perspective and our worldview and our politics, but in a way that we didn't really understand maybe until you look back at it and look at the shifts. And I think one of those big ones was the shift from Thatcher and Major to the New Labour government, to the Overton window created when the New Labour government came in and started talking about childhood poverty and started talking about the things that matter to working people and to people on the left. And I just really would really briefly want to ask you about the Overton window theory and how you came to that metaphor, that idea, and why you thought that was effective in pushing forward the argument that the golden era myth is a myth.
Yeah, I talked about that in the book, partly because the Overton window, it's an idea that has, I think it's originally an idea that the libertarian right in America talked about to describe where the political centre of gravity is at a given time. What are the parameters of what is considered doable and publicly sayable within the democracy? And I think it was increasingly borrowed by the Corbynite left and by some of Jeremy Corbyn's kind of outriders in the media as a way of analysing society. And their view was that by having Corbyn in, they would move the Overton window of the country to the left. Now, as it's happened, I would say that almost every question they moved the Overton window of the country has been moved to the right under Corbyn's watch, to the point where we have someone like Priti Patel with her kind of values as Home Secretary. But what I tried to do in the book was that it's quite easy for people on the centre-left to scoff at this Overton window idea and treat it as a bit of kind of pseudo-intellectual jargon. But actually, I think it's quite an interesting idea of really trying to understand how politics has changed and which things are not sayable anymore that were sayable a few decades ago, and vice versa. And what I tried to do in the book was to look at this kind of quite complicated series of shifts that have taken place over the past 70 years in terms of what the expectations of the country are, what the expectations, you know, what is politically sayable and politically doable now that wasn't 70 years ago and vice versa. So the way I've tried to use it is to take it seriously as an idea and to look at how things have actually changed. And I think when you do that, you get a much more complicated picture than this golden era idea of a really radical left-wing Overton window replaced by a really, really radical right-wing Overton window. And you get a much more complicated picture, but you also get a picture of the political centre of gravity always, in my view, moving towards the liberal left each time Labour is in power. Labour generally, when it leaves government, tends to leave the values of the country, I think, in a more progressive place and the laws of the country in a more progressive place than when it arrived in power. And I think one of the problems with the golden era is it prevents us from seeing this. We see everything as this decline. There's a quote that I use from George Monbiot, where he says, Labour always looks like their opponents with a 5-year lag. And what this means is that we're constantly, every time there's an outgoing Labour prime minister, we pretend they're a traitor or a sellout, you know, unfit to lace the boots of Keir Hardie or whoever it might be. And we are unable to actually look at the present and the changes that have been achieved and to build on those.
And I think the most convincing, I think one of the most convincing sentences in the entire book for me was when you say that the Overton window is predominantly shifted by those in power. And that is predominantly how you shift the political consensus. The Overton window is by getting left-wing governments in power, and that's how you move it to the left. I I mean, we're coming to the end of the time, so we're going to have to wrap up. I wish we could get into more about the book. I still have so many things I'd like to talk about with you. I hope we can revisit it at some point over the next few years as internal Labour Party politics and British politics moves along, and we can see where these myths are at some point in the future after being so prevalent in our movement over the last 5 years. And I want to thank you for your time today, but I also want to thank you for writing the book, because I think a couple of weeks ago I was a moderate, I was a centrist, I was whatever else. Now I'm a pluralist. I think now I predominantly identify as a pluralist, and that is genuinely as a consequence of having read the book. So thank you for writing it, for explaining, for articulating my politics for me so clearly, and for giving me a new perspective on how to view the struggles that we go through internally in the party and that left-wing politics is going through across the world. So thanks for writing in. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Joe. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.